Since this is an informal seminar, I don't have all transparency, so I'm going to be writing a bit better as well. So, what I wanted to talk about is non-Christianity. Russian between 0 and 1100. So, why this title? Well, because I think the consequences, if we find some non-Gaussianity, are so important that we better try to figure out as many tests as possible and also see if all these different tests are consistent. So,
non-Gaussianity
of the cosmological population field, primordial non-Gaussianity. So, two things you may think about for looking for non-Gaussianity are, for example, CMB and the large-scale structure. The advantages of looking at the CMB is that the statistical distribution of the fluctuation is close to their original form, but the signal is small because the fluctuation has not yet been amplified by gravity. While if you look at large-scale structure, you have the advantage that the signal has been amplified by gravity. But gravity is also a nonlinear process, so it introduces some deviation from Gaussianity due to this nonlinearity that they completely erase the nonlinear signal. So the fact that the signal is big is also a disadvantage. And then on top, you have all the complications that have to do with explosion. Galaxy formation, which is something that I'm missing. And then you can say, well, galaxies are biased. Still, something we don't really know. In the middle between these two extremes, we have objects like these that we can also use. This is a galaxy, a redshift 1.6, and those are different clusters. Now, these redshift objects are rare events, so we are probing the tails of the distribution, and then maybe easier to pick up some deviation from Gaussianity by looking at the tails. So, last year, with this is this here, we show the following. That if future CMB map turns out to be consistent with the Gaussian hypothesis, then any non-Gaussianity seen in the large-scale structural spectrum can be safely attributed to nonlinear gravity or bias. Now, first of all, what is the bias spectrum? I mean, most of you would know what the bias spectrum is, but just a definition is the Fourier transform of the three-point correlation function. And this is the bias spectrum. This is what the Fourier transform is, and it is different from zero. It is non-zero only if these three phase vectors form a closed triangle. So.
Well, yes. So this week, they're saying that if this future CMB map is consistent,
yeah. Turns out to be consistent with Gaussian.
Yeah. And there are several effects which will smooth out on Gaussian these in primordial populations. For example, the A of M has contributions of a wide range of K, so that's something that you can do at some level.
Yeah, so now my next step was, now I'm going to prove it. No, now I'm going to prove it. Now, yes. how did we do that? How did we figure out that the CMB was probably more sensitive to premodular non-Gaussianity than large-scale structure? So we looked at some non-Gaussian models, and we hope we choose some that were physically motivated and that satisfy observational constraint like CDM, like in order to fit observables. And the model we consider are basically three family of models. Let's say the first two I put them under just one family, and I say that now this, in case A, it is just the density of the fluctuation field. So in case A, this is delta rho over rho. Right? And in case B, is just the fluctuation field for the gravitational potential. Now, this is a Gaussian. This small phi is a Gaussian. And this is our non-Gaussianity parameter. Now, if this epsilon is zero, of course, density or potential in model A or B, this is Gaussian. If you tune this away from zero, then this becomes non-Gaussian. This was the first family, and then
the square field space. This is the square in real space.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then the other model was has to do with topological defect model, but we heard last week that they are dead, so I'm not going to concentrate on that. Even though they're not completely dead, but they're not that interesting. Then next we use the bispectrum as a discriminating statistic. Because what? I want to laugh as well. What's the joke? This is because it is the lowest order correlation that is zero for a Gaussian case. So in general, for a non-Gaussian distribution, you would expect it to be different from zero, even though this is not completely general. You may imagine to have a non-Gaussian distribution that has got by spectrum zero and higher order different from zero, but you sort of have to think hard. The general thing is just to say, well, then
the students. In class A, you got a smooth phi squared unsmooth. Square and unsmooth field, mm-hmm. which is not the same as the chi squared you get out of translation if you had as a curvature. Because that brings in squares on every scale and generates. So in the inflationary case, what you would get on the right hand side, I think, is the sum of phi squares and smooth on different scales. But here, you're going to use the square of the unsmooth phi.
Well, you will have to put a cutoff at a certain point. But the final result doesn't really depend as much on the cutoff. If you change the smoothing cutoff, the result doesn't change anything.
If you have a curvature, that would be a sum of squares of smooth field.
It depends which incision.
No, in any other curvature, generally, if you say that density comes from the square of a Gaussian field, and the Gaussian field is leaving a horizon, very generic statement, then the non-Gaussianity observed is actually a sum of phi squares, smooth on different scales.
Okay, this is just a parameterization. We just choose this parameterization and then see what we can do with it. Now, in case B, this has got to do with standard inflation, right? Because you have some higher order contribution that comes from something that looks like this. You are not convinced. Well, not really. I mean, saying non-Gaussian is like, you know, saying non-dog. I mean, you can choose any animal you want. So So you have to try to parameterize, and you just choose this parameterization. Of course, you may think about any other thing you want. But is the gravitational potential
the
okay?
The thing of here.
I guess. But this is what you get in the case of the standard inflation, slow roll inflation, right? You can actually relate this epsilon here to the slow roll inflation parameters, this epsilon and eta, yes. Okay, to do the comparison between detecting on gas anything CMB and large scale structure, you need to have a way to know what's the minimum error on this parameter you can detect from. So what is the minimum epsilon you can detect from large scale structure and from CMB. Now, to figure out the number for large scale structure, we use the result of a series of papers. I'm going to write here just the last one of the series. So, where they have encountered the most turbine in 98 in Molden offices. And this, in this paper, we show that it's possible to do a likelihood analysis of the bias spectrum of large scale structure and extract some parameters out of it. So you parameterize the large scale structure bias spectrum in a certain way and then apply to large scale structure, to the bias spectrum or large scale structure the likelihood analysis and extract those parameters. And we found out also the minimum error on those parameters, so the minimum value for this parameter that you can extract from large scale structure. Yes. It depends on the inflationary model, right? But this is expected to be. Yeah. In order to have slow roll inflation, just the condition for slow roll inflation has to be less than one. And this doesn't have anything to do with a specific model. Okay? Now, the result for large scale structure looks something like this. This is from a simulation. Now, this. This parameter here is just the overall amplitude of the bias spectrum, while this parameter here is directly related to this. It's just a linear combination of this with a bunch of 2 in front and 5 and things like that. So now this is the likelihood contour, 68% of 1 sigma and 19%. And this is just from a 100 megaparsec size box. Now, you can, of course, forecast what sort of error you will have from a survey like this Sloan. And the error is going to shrink quite a lot. Of course, we are not taking into account real-world issues that you always have with real surveys, like this is from a simulation.
An
unbiased simulation. So, yeah. But it tells you what sort of error you would expect on this quantity. So what is the minimum quantity that you can distinguish from zero because you just fly outside these contours. Now, of course, this ln is much bigger than the simulation, so the error on this parameter will be about 10 to the minus 2. So the smallest C2 that you would get, that you can distinguish from 0, would be of the order of 10 to the minus 2. If you want the mathematical detail for the likelihood analysis, I think look in the paper. I'm not going to bother you with all the maths. Yeah. But if you think about it, this is just an overall amplitude of the bispectrum, and this one is directly related to this. If you assume there is no bias in the galaxy distribution. So the error that I'm going to take for this C2 is assuming that the real universe doesn't have bias, doesn't have Hesse-space distortion, have little shot noise, you know exactly how the selection function goes, you don't have bright star drills and all this other stuff that always comes in when you have real data. Now, to do a similar likelihood analysis for the CND bispectrum, you do something like this. Now, you know that CND by spectrum is something like that. These are the coefficient when you expand your distribution. Spherical harmonics. And this is the equivalent that you have. Okay, so
why doesn't he just use the microphone they were using before?
Because they don't want to get your comments. Not you in particular.
Or get off the island.
So a little bit of math, since you can write the bispectrum in that way, then you can do a likelihood analysis on the CMB bispectrum in this way. Now, if you're interested at the math, look at the paper, otherwise, trust me. And we apply this, as I say, to different physically motivated non-Gaussian models, and always end up that here it is. Here it is. And always end up that the CMB put stronger constraints on with respect to large scale structure. For example, this is what I call here model A. Now, the CMB ends up here only considering L up to 100, but you know that from future mission we will be able to go up to very L much higher than that, even though we will have other problems to overcome, like foregrounds and.
Yes.
And for the large scale structure, I'm assuming you know perfectly well the position of your galaxies, have no bias, blah 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 blah. So.
Alpha is
alpha. And that alpha is epsilon. It's exactly the same thing. Different paper, different Greek letter.
You should use C for all of them.
Yes, that's a good idea. So Well, in this case, large-scale stretch is marginally better than CMB, but for example, for the potential, it's two orders of magnitude, but CMB is two orders of magnitude better than large-scale structure. And for this topological defects model, again, large-scale stretch is two orders of magnitude worse. But what about if things were non-Gaussian, only on scales smaller than CMB scales, smaller or scales that are not accessible from CMB experiments? So what we decided to do is to look at the abundance of higher redshift objects like galaxies and clusters. And this is the explanation why this might work. So imagine this phi, it is a one-dimensional Gaussian field. And then you apply to it a transformation similar to this one, where epsilon now is just unity. Now, and this gives you the red line. As you can see, what this mapping does is just changing the PDF, because where you have a small peak, you amplify it a little. When you have a big peak, it gets amplified a lot. Where you have a small trough, almost nothing happens. Where you have a big trough, you almost have a local maximum there. Now, to extract this sort of information from actual observations, you need to use to extend the pressure recipe to non-Gaussian initial condition. Now, you have different ways of doing this. You can either do it with numerical simulations, now generate a lot of non-Gaussian initial condition, evolve the simulation, and look how the PDF look like and find a fitting formula. Or you can try to do it analytically. The problem with numerical simulation is that if you look at rare event, at the tails of the distribution, you may incur in problems that have to do with the finite size of your simulation box and the finite grid resolution. So it's nice to have sort of an analytical counterpart to test your simulation. Well,
you use the simulations to show that you can just
show the press sector still works
in the
almost.
But I'm not sure it's exactly.
You want to do it both ways, two different approaches, and then see if you converge or not. If you converge, fine. If you don't converge, then you have a problem. Now, I don't want to go too much into the details, but I want to tell you where the problem lies. Now, to calculate, to generalize, let's say, the Bresch-Schechter approach, you need to calculate this quantity. Now, this is the PDF, and you have to integrate the PDF from the threshold for collapse to infinity. And now, this quantity is easy to find for, and I have an analytical extraction for Gaussian initial condition. Okay. But for non-Gaussian initial condition, it's a problem, because this quantity is smoothed, has to be smoothed on a certain radius r that corresponds to a certain mass m. And that's where the problem arises. Because if you have an expression like this, then your PDF will look something like that, where in here you have the transfer function and the smoothing. And now this becomes non-local. You have a y here, and an x there, and an x there. And you're integrating over y. And this is complicated to solve.
But since the sum of the Gaussians is not replaced with n degrees of freedom, where n may not be an integer. I mean, you're taking a chi-square distribution, mixing it into the Gaussian, and then your smoothing says I'm going to combine different chi-squares, which are kind of independent, not quite. But in some sense, you would think, at least in the limit, that smoothing over a lot of them, this thing behind the epsilon is a chi-square with some large degrees of, or even not so large degrees of freedom, and for that we actually know the exact expression, and we think that. At the end of the day, it should look something like that, at least, you would think.
Not really, because...
Epsilon, when you do that, you find that the only solution that comes out from there analytically, when epsilon is very small,
yeah.
You don't question that the phi squared, it is not the dominant contribution to the Gaussian field. So that's why it doesn't...
This is different. Well, this is different. I mean, what you are thinking, I think, is here you have at x1 and here you have x2. I think that's what you are thinking. But here you have the same position. And that complicated the things a lot.
Remember, it was
no, it is the same. But it is possible to do it. And what we find is the following, that for mildly non-Gaussian cases, what happens is that the introduction of a small primordial non-Gaussianity lowers the threshold for collapse of high-redshift objects in this way. So this is the skewness created by the introduction of this term. And this is the delta C is the threshold for collapse. And now, as you can see, you lower the threshold for collapse more when you go to higher and higher redshift. Because in an Einstein de Sitter universe, delta C of Z will go like delta C of 0 times 1 plus Z. So that's why, looking at rare events, you can pick up more easily primordial non-Gaussianity of that sort. Yes, in an Einstein Sitter case for the press sector, the original press sector, in principle, you could try to generalize this to, I don't know, the Schacht and Torment, right? And then you would just change delta C to something else, but the effect would be the same.
It's actually delta C as you would extrapolate to today in linear theory?
Yes, that one. Well, just the threshold for collapse, whatever you decide to choose as the threshold for collapse.
Right, well...
But threshold for the field...
Yes,
yes.
And now, this is, for example, the effect that something like this does for model A on this quantity that's proportional to the number of objects that you will create at that redshift at a given mass. The thick line is a Gaussian, and the other line are varying this epsilon. So the effect is not small, it's orders of magnitude. Okay. For example, for going from here to here, right? This is of order of 10 to the minus 1. Skewness is of order of 10 to the minus 1. Which is, in model A, this epsilon is very small to get 10 to the minus 1. This epsilon is of order of 10 to the minus 4. Is it in there? Now, this was a quantity that may not be that useful. This is a quantity that is more useful because this is actually the number of objects for a given mass at a given redshift. Now, we are assuming that the redshift at which you observe the object is the redshift of collapse, which sort of makes sense because you are looking at high redshift. So. Notice that it's very difficult to get accurate determination of masses of high redshift objects, like, for example, a galaxy of, I don't know, 10 to the 12 for a mass of a redshift 8. So one has to consider, well, imagine I don't know the mass by an uncertainty of 100%, which is about a factor of 2. Then, you see, I may think that galaxy is... 2 10 to the 12 solar masses, right? And see it and say, oh, then I have non-Gaussian initial condition. But maybe that mass is actually only 10 to the 12 solar masses, and then you are perfectly consistent with Gaussian initial condition. So let's say that a believable error in the mass determination may be something like an order of a factor of 2 in the uncertainty. And let's keep that in mind. And for clusters, of course, you cannot set cluster redshift 10, so you have to consider only object per redshift 2, if you are really, really lucky, 3. Right? And this is the ratio between the number you would expect in non-Gaussian case and the number you would expect in the Gaussian case. And this for different values of the skewness parameter. Pardon? Well, maybe they're not there, right? So that's the next transparency. So if you really want to consider those objects are... I'm going to answer your question. If you really want to use those objects as proof for primordial non-Gaussianity, you have to make sure that in the Gaussian case, you would expect at least one of those objects in the whole sky, right? Otherwise, it doesn't make that much sense. And this calculates the number of objects you would expect in the whole sky for different masses using the standard redshifter Gaussian initial condition, and then versus redshift. Now, down here, you have clusters. Small, medium, large, and up here you have galaxies, small, medium, large.
I mean, if you had a model that predicted 0.001 clusters in the whole sky at a redshift of 5 and you found one, that'd be tremendous falsification.
Yes, but if you want to do something conservative, then the most natural thing to do is to say, well, also because you don't observe the whole sky. I mean, with the Hubble deep field, you observe a very, very small patch of the sky, so...
It's not like it would succeed, but if you found it, it would give it.
Yes.
But the important point is what she's going to tell you later on. If that were the case, you would be able to see the non-Gaussianity in the CMB by eye.
This is my conclusion, actually.
Tell them not to steal your
conclusion. Don't steal my punchline. Okay, so we are running late, so I better speed up. So remember this argument about the mass uncertainty of about a factor 2 for galaxies, and let's say to be totally optimistic, let's say 30% in the mass of a cluster, determination of a cluster, and this will mean that. You have to observe a factor 100 more galaxy high redshift than you would expect in the Gaussian case in order to be sure that this is not due to an error in the mass determination. For the cluster, since the error in the mass is smaller, because it's probably easier, probably Joe will say no, but to determine the mass of a cluster, this factor is 10 and not 100. So what I plot here is the ratio, so the total number of galaxies of objects you would expect at a mass bigger than a given mass in a certain redshift versus the Gaussian case. And this ratio, we want it to be 10 for clusters, 100 for galaxies. And we only want to consider masses for which, in the Gaussian case, you would expect at least one object in the whole sky. So these lines, this is for galaxies, and model A, this is for clusters, model B. Now, this is this ratio, and the lines are plotted only when I would expect at least one object in the whole sky. Now, your threshold is here, and your threshold here is here. So I would say that the minimum non-Gaussianity you can detect from galaxies at high redshift is 5, 10, 10 to the minus 4 for model A, and from clusters about minus 200 for model B. Now, why do I put a minus here? Because if you think about it, only a negative epsilon will give you a positive skewness. A positive epsilon will give you a negative skewness. Now, in the CMB determination, it doesn't matter the sign of epsilon. But when you look at high redshift objects, of course, you are going to detect objects that form in excess of the Gaussian case, not in defect. Right? Especially if you look at high redshift. That's why these are good. These high redshift objects are good only for model A positive epsilon and model B negative epsilon, while CMB is good for all signs of epsilons. But the minimum epsilon positive you can detect with high redshift galaxies is bigger than the one you could detect with the CMB. So these are my conclusions. Let us consider model A. The absolute value for epsilon is, from the CMB, the minimum epsilon is 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 2, about that. And positive and negative sign, you detect both. From large scale structure is 10 to the minus 2, but with all the caveats, no redshift space distortion, no all the rest. And again, you can detect positive and negative.
Is this for 100
meters? No, this is from a survey like the Sloan. So projecting the error you would get in a survey as big as the Sloan. And high redshift galaxies will tell you, will detect a minimum epsilon of 5, 10 to the minus 4, but only if it is positive. I don't consider clusters for this model because that basically has no effect on clusters. Now, for model B, the minimum epsilon from the CMB is of order 10. Again, plus or minus, you detect them both. For large-scale structure, it's 2 orders of magnitude worse. But for cluster, a high redshift has to be at least 200, and again, with minus sign. Now, this epsilon is of the order of magnitude that you would expect to explain the cluster that was found of a mass of about 10 to the 15 solar masses at redshift 0.83. And you will need a non-Gaussianity of that sort and of about this, in this ballpark, to explain that cluster. In a lambda CDM, not in an ICMC. If you want to have that cluster as a one sigma fluctuation, then that's what you need. Okay.
Clusters, one sigma.
The clusters are unbiased. No, that means that the new thing is if the clusters were everywhere.
Yeah.
No, one sigma.
What sigma is?
I mean, if you want to have a 68% probability on that patch of the sky, I mean, you take that patch of the sky and find that sort of cluster, then you need that sort of non-Gaussianity.
Which patch?
Yes.
If you're really conservative on the systematic uncertainties in the data, I think that statement will become weaker.
Okay, fine. This is just an example.
How is it going to generate with different cosmology?
I'm taking the worst case scenario, right? Because if you take an Einstein de Sitter, then you predict less cluster, so you need a much bigger non-Gaussianity. But I don't think you can be that precise to determine cosmological parameter. I think you can do something more like...
So if you are in a sphere, then you do not expect a redshift also.
No, at all.
Then it should be easier to detect non-Gaussianity if you see one.
Yeah, but the universe is not Einstein de Sitter. Or at least...
Okay.
Yeah, it should be much easier to detect non-Gaussianity. So you need non-Gaussianity if you want that the universe is Einstein de Sitter, but maybe the universe is not Einstein de Sitter. So you should put yourself in the worst case scenario, and then, so the scenario that needs the less amount of non-Gaussianity. But the main point of this is that if those clusters are really to be explained with this sort of non-Gaussianity, then this is an order of magnitude bigger than what you would explain from the CNB, what you would need from the CNB. So basically, if this is true, then you may also almost see it by eye in the CNB.
So we just got it all riled up with the statement that this shows that for any time on Gaussianity, the CMB is more sensitive.
I didn't mean anything. Okay. The model that we consider.
Right. And this is certainly a motivated model. So.
No, but this is adiabatic inflation, Mary. This is a model where you have adiabatic cashflow fluctuations. But it's. As a curvature, though, would have much weaker limits.
Don't get something that looks more or less like that, regardless of whether that non-Gaussian data comes from adiabatic fluctuations in the interval, or whether it comes from some secondary isocurvature.
Except you've got all these different things, like epsilon, put on the uncorrelated, you have a separate field. I mean, in the implicon field, your chi squared is probably the chi.
Yeah, in the implicon field, you can relate epsilon to the slope.
Yes, whereas if you have a free field, it's a free parameter.
And you've got some second spectator.
That's right. You've got a free parameter, epsilon, and those two are uncorrelated now, phi and chi squared.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
The particular set of models seems to have a significantly altered PDF, not only on the tail, but sort of near the middle of it. Whereas in the other models, the ones we worked on, not considered at all.
Yeah.
They have altered really more only on the tail. And in that case, I would imagine that the CMB is not a very good tracer. And we know that clusters are, in fact.
Yes. From the large-scale fracture unit, said that we used a fraction likelihood analysis to say more words on this.
I have a question.
Just a rough statement about what we call.
Okay, so. An order of energy of this sort will give a lot of scope structure by spectrum that will look like
this. Oh, so it's from the bi-spectrum.
Pardon?
So you're analyzing
the bi-spectrum. The bi-spectrum, yes. It will give you a bi-spectrum that looks like this. Now, this is the practitioner instability class. So you will get this also from the oscillation condition plus another term. Let's go to see. Well, that epsilon goes directly to here. Now, since this is a known function of the simple vector, now you know how to model this graph. Now, you have a parameter here, and you observe this, you observe the product spectrum. So, you are exact in the term of the analytic analysis.
So, you assume that you know what the product means?
Yes. Now, if you have some linear biasing, then you will get another thing. In front of here, and linear biasing will be here, and that is here. If you have no linear biasing, then in this term, you have one part of the term bias, plus one part of the term that is another linear sample. And the simplification that I made for giving the minimum epsilon was that this is one and this doesn't exist.
What are you assuming for the sampling statistics in this? quantity, or if you like, in the micrometric formulating it. And you have to assume some distribution for the same dimension.
Well, since you have many, many, many modes, you can use a Gaussian type. Especially when you scale the standards. Right. And then around the peak, you may be able to check. Once you get only 14 modes, this doesn't want to apply, but the experiment is going to be huge. And this approximation is also to do a simulation of around 100 megabytes. And then you're going to cover if you underline it. If you want to see so many of the that's the right approximation.
Well, the question is, do you recover the errors on them too?
Mm.
You can use our Monte-Carlo simulation to assess probably what significance at which you can determine it. But it's not whether you can recover the number, but whether you can recover the error on the
error. Well, the Monte-Carlo did a lot of simulations, so it's not that easy. So what we did, a big simulation. And split it in smaller simulation and see how the thing value goes in more or less this quantity. Now, we don't need to carry 68%, it's not 68, it's maybe 65. We are talking about the network.
Can you put back the over 50 for the ratio of carbon and plastic? The very one interesting thing from there is that the number of shiny in the galaxies only appears when you are at redshifts that are bigger than 9 or 10. So completely uncharted territory so far. There's no way to see it, even at redshift of 5, 6, or 7. You really have to go to ultra high redshift.
Well, it
will
appear,
it's that
you won't have a factor
exactly.
Of much bigger than 10. You will since
not
the mass determination is 6 or 7, then you find a way to determine the
mass of those
galaxies.
When you say the limits on epsilon, what do you use for a cluster data set? You know, for CMBX, it looks like epsilon for the types of clusters that we see. I guess some number of galaxies type of here.
Well, I'm just calculating the minimum epsilon that tells you, that gives you a ratio of 10 between the number of individuals and the number of individuals versus the number of individuals in the galaxy.
It's just based upon how well it's changed to measure the mass of the object.
Right, okay.
Yes. And this, also quite interesting, which instead of using the standard of checking, we use the standard of checking.